Morning. Today I'm going to tell you guys a little story about some work I've been doing that I'm generally titling Red Dirt and Forest Management, Treatment, Crystallinity, and the Alteration of Carbon and Stability in Managed Systems. We're going to scale up, definitely. We're not going to have a lot of really advanced analytical procedures here. It's going to be more of a general talk. So we can appreciate that forest management can alter soil carbon site dynamics, both initially through disturbance and oxidation of native carbon, as well as over time through changes to both the quantity and quality of litter inputs that go into the soil system. And this is going to lead me right to two very general questions, both related to managed forest plantations, especially in California. What effects do simple and diverse litter inputs have on soil carbon storage? In specific, with respect to organometallic complexes as extracted with sodium pyrophosphate, and back in general, what role does mineralogy or parent material play in these interactions? So I'm using the opportunity to both pub and talk about the Garden of Eden experiment, which is a kind of unique and interesting forestry experiment in Northern California that was established in the mid-1980s to test the factors that control the growth of a plantation in Mediterranean climate. This experiment wasn't initially directly designed to look at treatment effects of soil or treatment effects on soil properties, but it did have soils in mind. It was set up with different levels of productivity across the landscape, but it was a true forestry experiment. But it does provide a very interesting set of conditions and constraints to look at not only traditional treatments, but also the litter conditions that those treatments apply or create on a plot. The thing that's nice about it is a completely randomized block design that has three replicates at each site in the field. And that experimental design that you see here on the right, that was replicated across the landscape with the exact same format, size, dimension, and treatments. So what I'm going to talk about today is how I've taken these treatments and how I'm kind of viewing them in a different way than kind of the traditional treatment. I'm looking at them as ways to constrain both simple and diverse litter inputs into a system. And here in this table, you can see the treatments that I'll be talking about. To control an herbicide-applied plot, where herbicide is applied multiple times to control understory vegetation. A fertilized plot, which I'm looking at, is almost a second control because there was no control of the vegetation, but the site was enhanced through fertilization, and then across those treatments. And you can see in the table, I'm considering the simple treatments, the ones that had herbicide applied, so only pine litter was the main input in that system, and the diverse litters have both the pine inputs as well as understory litter inputs, both through manzanita and C-notes, depending on the site. And then I'm considering a second variable to constrain those and look at them in comparison, and that's kind of this enhanced idea where either they had fertilization applied or they didn't. And so I've got two pairs, a simple and a diverse set to the control on the herbicide, and then another set with the fertilization and the controlled herbicide-fertilization combination. So I don't think back to this idea about how this experiment was set up, but they picked a really nice set of sites that really kind of represent almost end members of these soils. I'll be nominally calling these the Aiken and the Palatin. They had different names in the publications, but I'm using those for clarity. Those are the names of the soil series that those sites have. The Aiken site is just east of Redding, and the Palatin site is in the Feather River country east of Oroville, California. They're taxonomically almost identical. They're both fine to fine loamy, mesic, parasesquic, andic, or xeric haploid peat moulds. But they're really contrasting in the parent material that they developed on, with the Aiken site sitting on a intermediate to mafic volcanic mudflow or lahar, and the Palatin site being sitting on an airfall tephra that varies in depth at the surface. That's underlain by a metadiorite that's very felsic. So a very iron-rich and mixed system here that's uniform, relatively, and a system that's got an ash over very quartzy material. They're essentially at the same elevation, so that's not a big issue, but where the other real contrasting factor comes in is when you look at the precipitation. So the Aiken site is about 1,100 millimeters of rainfall per year, where the Palatin site's at almost 1,800. And that difference makes a huge a huge influence on the amount of kind of inherent productivity at those sites with them, which kind of is indicated through the site index, which is the rate of growth for a time period. And this is site index at 50 years. So about 23 meters of growth over 50-year period is estimated at the Aiken, with about 30 meters at the Powelton. The Powelton is probably one of the finer, more productive sites for tree growing in California. So the sampling that we did was consistent across both sites. We took out a geoprobe, and we sampled, I probably mentioned or didn't, that each one of the replicates, or each one of the treatments had three replicates per site. We sampled each one of those replicate sites twice to a depth of 2 meters, about 20 years after the treatments were established. Today I'll be only talking about the top 30 centimeters, but there's an interesting story throughout the whole two meters of soil. I'm trying to set up this contrast of similarity and difference. So I'm just going to show you this data for laser granulometry. So particle size distribution is measured with a laser. All site by treatment combinations are represented with 12 replicates, so a pretty good sample size at each depth at each site. The top shows you kind of a traditional table of clay, silt, and sand size particle classes and a texture. The bottom figure shows you kind of the cumulative distribution, or what those particles look like, not just in a bin, but across the range of sizes. The take-home story here is that they're essentially the same. There's not really a lot of difference in texture between these two sites, which is kind of a nice thing to have when you're trying to look at mechanisms that aren't about texture. So we can move forward from that. So moving on to mineralogy, these sites, once again, are very similar, but that's kind of inherent to their pedogenesis. They both have rich kaolinite in both sites, but one of the main differences here is I've kind of classified these into poorly crystalline and highly crystalline sites. The Aiken site on the mud flow, or the mafic material, has more poorly crystalline X-ray diffraction peaks that are jagged and broad. There's a range, there's a little section here where there's some goethite and probably a range of iron oxides. And in contrast, the Powelton site has some very clean and very crystalline kaolinite as well as gibbsite. I mean, that's almost like a needle, it's so clean. So you have this contrast. To further characterize the mineralogy, we also use thermal analysis. And thermal analysis is a really really consistent and really accurate way to try to assess both kaolinite and gibbsite due to their decomposition characteristics related to temperature. So on the left, we have the Aiken, this poorly crystalline site, which has a very nice, if you're not used to seeing thermal analysis data, this is the derivative of weight loss, which is kind of illustrative of kind of the rate of how things are going. And you can see here a very characteristic and steep weight loss in the region where kaolinite would be found, and probably some information about gibbsite in there, or goethite, but it's kind of difficult. There's a lot of interference in there with organics and other things. On the opposite side, the Powelton, which had a really nice, clean, crystalline X-ray diffraction peak, doesn't have a huge signal of weight loss, but it has a really nice signal of weight loss for gibbsite. So by using both these methods, we get kind of a better understanding of both the types of minerals and the amount. We didn't quantify this yet, but we're going to get to that and try to actually tie down the amounts. So moving on, we'll be talking with the next two, the main data slides we'll be seeing are going to be the same format, a box and Wister plot with the site by treatment combination mean for the 0 to 30 centimeter pool of soil we summarized across those three surface depths. Just a quick reminder about box plots, the dot in the middle is the median of the distribution. The box itself represents the 25th and 75th quartiles of the distribution, and the whiskers basically represent kind of the edges of the distribution that are still within reality. If there was a dot up here, that dot would represent data that was outside of the distribution. So the first thing that you can see that jumps out at you is that both sites aren't the same kind of variability. The Powelton site, which remember had a tephra mantle over the top, it's really variable, and I think that represents the depth of that ash or that tephra. For example, in both the fertilized and the control sites, you might have a sample from 20 to 30 centimeters that would be a kilogram per meter squared of carbon, and one of the other plots it might be 4. So there's a couple of those sites across this experimental site that kind of confounds some of the treatment effects that you might see there. But real strong treatment effects at the other site, where remember that site was a little less productive and didn't have quite the productivity as the Palatin site. And you see a real bump in bulk carbon based on enhancing productivity through fertilization and also through the combination treatments. Statistically a very significant relationship. The next thing I really want to point out, and this is kind of addressing the first question that I brought up, is that when you look at each pair, remember we had a base fertility pair of control and herbicide, and then this enhanced pair that was fertilizing. And each one of these across both sites, the herbicide treatment, that simple pine-only treatment, seems to have a lowered bulk carbon content across all sites, which is kind of interesting. There's other people that are working on this, and there's plenty of discussion about litter quality and its effects on carbon cycling, but that's probably for another time. I had my little animation, but I didn't use it. So as you can see there, even within the pairs, a little difference. Either you can view it as the diverse litters are promoting carbon accumulation, or you can view it as the simple litters are actually eating into the native carbon pool. And those questions will probably be answered at a little later date with more data than I have today. When you back off kind of and look at the site-based parameters, if you take into account the wild variability at this site, it looks like the sites have a greatly different carbon content on average across treatments. But when you use the median, which might be a more representative metric in this case because of that wild variability, they're really not that different. Even though this site is not an order of magnitude greater in productivity, but it's considerably more productive. And I think what this is really illustrating is kind of what both the previous speakers has pointed out, is that there's probably a lot more kind of sorptive surface area that's not being used at this site. And you bump it with some productivity and the site responds by storing some of that carbon. So moving on to kind of the gist of the story today, I guess, is that trying to look at organometallic complex carbon with pyrophosphate, and kind of the same story applies. The general trend that I showed between the two simple and complex litter systems don't really work here as much across sites, but it really comes out cleanly or comes out amplified in the more crystalline site. And I'm still trying to work it out in my mind, and I think, like I said, more the rest of the data that we're developing is needed to really pin it down. But you can see that even just on simple subtraction, that the previous slide, we're talking about 1.1 kilograms per meter squared difference on this one, and almost 1.5 on that one. And if you just subtracted those from our sites, it's not all going into that pool. So obviously, some other part of the mineral matrix there is just sucking up some of that carbon. So my big idea, which is a talk I didn't get to finish, was I was going to try to measure the residue of the oxalate and the thionate extractable. This soil just sucked up citrate. And I couldn't, I was getting carbon quantities that were greater than the total when I tried to use them, so that really shot most of my talk. And kind of the same thing. Even though this site seems to have more carbon, it actually seems to have less of a pyrophosphate or complex pool. I think part of it is the fact that it's kind of that idea, there's not a lot of iron available, and maybe there isn't a lot of iron that can be complex. There might be a lot of aluminum. It was really complicated. I had a good slide that showed these really great linear relationships between pyrophosphate, iron, and carbon, and they're very different. I mean, the amount of iron to carbon here is really high. The ratio is really high, which you'd think would be the other way because there's so much iron available. But I almost think that the crystallinity and the lack of iron is promoting kind of cycling of iron through that complex pool more readily. And so just to prove that it wasn't just the surface, a lot of times it would be just that surface soil that would do all the treatment. These treatments, carried out throughout the top 30 centimeters of soil, which was kind of surprising, but it's nice to see. A lot of times people will talk about only that top inch or top 3 inches, but in this case, the top foot of that soil has been affected pretty heavily after only 20 years of treatment effects. So in closing, my conclusions are very simple and they're very preliminary, there'll be more concrete and there'll be more statistics and that kind of stuff in the future. But basically, I can conclude that the simple or reduced litter, or the diverse or the simple litter system of pine only conceptually reduced carbon concentrations both at the bulk level, or the diverse litter increased it, depending on how you want to look at it. And that's probably, I'm leaning towards a little bit of both. You know, narrowing down the inputs that go into the system, the microbes aren't getting a well-balanced diet, so to speak. In this case, they're probably getting a variety of things. And this question really ties into what is the role of brush and the evolution of the site, and how the different litters might play a role in site capital development. The quantity of complex carbon was similar to both sites, even though there was it appeared to be that they were different, but when you broke it down, they really, it might be more of an intrinsic thing, like Catherine was saying, that the amount of carbon, it's kind of driven by the quantity, not so much some other mechanism. Strong treatment effect, which I think is kind of novel and exciting in and of itself, and that just kind of to a nod to this thing, well, crystallinity matters, and we all know that. It's a kind of a duh thing, but you know, I only have two sites, so we can't really draw too big of a conclusion from it, but some of the other people's sites that we're talking about today and bigger pictures might be able to tease this out a little bit more. And there's a lot more data to come, so stay tuned.